This is East End Inc. Organic farming pioneer Scott Chasky is the retired director of the Quail Hill Farm in Amagansett, New York, that he led for 30 years. He was a founding member of the New York chapter of NOFA, the Northeast Farming Association. And he's also a poet and writer of works on organic agriculture. In April 2020, in celebration of Earth Day, Scott Chasky read from his poetry and prose at an online session produced by Canio's Cultural Cafe. Here is Scott Chasky.
There is a spirit which is mind and life, light and truth in vast spaces. He contains all works and desires and all perfumes and all tastes. He enfolds the whole universe and in silence is loving to all. This is the spirit that is in my heart, smaller than a grain of rice or a grain of barley or a grain of mustard seed or a grain of canary seed or the kernel of a grain of canary seed. This is the spirit that is in my heart, greater than the earth, greater than the sky, greater than heaven itself, greater than all these worlds. This is the spirit that is in my heart. This is Brahma. This is just one ode. This was written mostly at a time where I had really opened up to the world of nature in a way that I hadn't seen when I grew up in the suburbia outside of Buffalo, New York. So this is the scene here is in Maine, in southern Maine, along the Saco River, in a beautiful mixed hardwood. He slows at the oak tier, yards to the river. Near a beach wave's leaf left of winter's chafe. Sand bed pocket stone constant of flood led into thicket. Silken marks the young leaf. Dry weeds crest in her hair, though he sees wet roots on her bed. He picks the pulp of apple root, sweats in sun, brushes shad, broods for lack of ore, shade and flood. Sun, for her bed, turn the root pulp red. I'm going to read a poem actually that I wrote for my mother while I was living in Oxford. This is called Poem for My Mother, beginning with a line by Wallace Stevens. Now in the time of winter, I think of trillium, myrtle, and viburnum of your garden. The delicate red beads of your cotton ester cluster the walls of Oxford. It grew so wide in your garden, you cut it back small, strong brush and clover-like leaves resting on the terrace beams. Perhaps in memory, a burn runs there through the flush lawn as in the high land of Glendalough. I need to say that in art, the eye grows into the event, the emerald mat, beech, white ash, and ivory forest light, which is like felt time. Then the unease as you turn from a stare, I learn, is not shame, but our fear of emptiness, the lost wholeness. As you bend in your rock garden, your brown and silver hair tips to a gentle pistol and opening sepal. Over a table, when we lived in the West, you spoke to me of the clear night. I came out alone into the library courtyard. I turned to the high columns to trace for your entrance a way through shadow. Sorrow returns to us. It moves in its wide waves as a purple vine for the western sky. How high it is to the first star of first power, a capella as I rise to sing in the time of spring. Aria in C. Late winter wet and privet hedge and fuchsias red, the dressed white of cove wind. East wind stirs fabric among stones, clothes woven by cliff stream and cold. My eye records diffuse and difficult tones, sea chants and chance bucklings of branch and cone, self shimmer of earth change, list list here within range of touch, sense and sounds I am other to resist. Lute notes of moorland ease with night shadow into morning, and unearth a music that gentle light gives to eyes in a play of days. Meadow man, house scholar, from field to chair, I hear the deep choir of the anvil, iron and rust, irony, dust. Then Nordic beat breaks to summer. Willows wave, elderberry beads gift the cloud. Dog rose shades the shore. In a measure of rage, I know the weightlessness of innocence. At dawn, silken nursery tents spin the field to song. Sea air, violet betony stare, shake the man to make of breath a mortal joy. And this one goes back to the time in Cornwall, and it's called Mary's Day. For those who don't know, Mary's Day is August 15th. This particular Mary's Day was August 15th, 2002. The oaks which surround my home, and probably yours, are full just now of the sound of cicadas, and below in the understory, a symphony of crickets. There are several words which rise to mind out of this summer music, gifts of the garden, and I would like to name them here. Abundance, beauty, joy. And given your indulgence, I would like to talk about myself a little in relation to the garden. It was while living in Ireland and England in the late 1970s and the decade of the 80s that I was captured by wood nymphs, piskies, the queen under the hill, the green man, and other ancient mythologies which flow out of the soil. I lived for a time in and around Oxford on the edge of the Cotswolds, where I learned how to handle a spade while digging vegetable gardens on Borers Hill. I remember an encounter on a narrow country lane with an 80-year-old Englishman who lectured me concerning the country life and the only two books worth reading, the Bible and Shakespeare. Quoting Shakespeare, useful advice for a gardener, he said, "Sweet are the uses of adversity, which like the toad, ugly and venomous, wears yet a precious jewel in his head." And then he cocked his head and said, "Imagine the man thinking of a toad at that moment." The language of the garden and the language of poetry for me are inseparable. Ilex opaca for Elaine de Kooning. The blue hills are a haze before the sun is born, and I look up under the mountain shape. American holly to the small birds that ferry 40 feet high, bone to branch, ecstatic with melody taken from air. I moved there to hear the small slap on leaves, pock, opaca, of what? What is it? Then under the great sister tree, I saw the red berries descend, tree fruit like a patter of wings on the palms of leaves, fruit the birds, greedy with music, let fall a rain of red baca unto red earth. Abundance is the mother of morning. The ecstasy of the animal world descends from every tree, bacchic with colors, to fall up into the sun, going into the lips of the goddess. It is certainly appropriate on Mary's Day to read a poem in celebration of the goddess, in this case, the Egyptian goddess Nut. Elaine de Kooning was called the White Goddess, for those who don't know, by many of her artist friends. Megan and I lived for 8 years in England. We met there, were married there, owned our first home, had our first child there. We lived on a hillside above the tiny fishing village of Mousel, Cornwall, and Love Lane. In a collection of eccentric buildings, Love Lane Cottage, Love Lane Studio, and Green Hedges, once owned by the Bird Ladies, Pog and Dorothy Iglesias, who maintained a correspondence with Megan for 10 years after Megan, at age 12, responded to Dorothy's book, The Cry of a Bird, with a poem. We learned to shelter from the winds, to hide under the canopy of a Cornish hedgerow when the next shower arrived, usually at intervals of about 10 minutes. To recognize wild garlic, nettle, daffodils, and narcissi pushing up out of dark soil and granite rock by the thousands, and covering the unused cliff meadows with white sails, and a sea of bluebells, brilliant and ethereal, in the magical wood at St. Loy. It was here that I learned the art of cliff meadow gardening from Edgar Wallace, who spent his whole life in the village, which was protected by a granite wall built in 1392. In lieu of a mantle or laurel crown, I knelt on the cliffs of the ancient duchy to receive the tools of the trade, a sharp sickle, the long-handled shovel, and the curved chipper. Edgar was almost 80 when we met, with a lifetime of telentates and searching for the right violet stock, the winter flower. When I first arrived, Edgar taught me how to prune pittosporum, used as backing for flowers, and I became a card-carrying member of Cornwall Farmers. The violets, packed in a shoebox in pittosporum, 8 to 10 stems bundled together, were transported by lorry to Covent Garden, and the gardener counted his pennies. So Edgar shared with me his meadow knowledge, and after 30 years of singing in the Mousel male voice choir, our labor was often accompanied by his songs. Were you there when they crucified my Lord, or oddly, Shenandoah? He spoke of plants as part of our family, and he handled them with tenderness and authority. He knew their moods and feelings as shown in leaves and roots. He knew the roots taken by fox and badger and rabbit. Returning home in the evening, he would stop along Love Lane to shout, "Scott, where to?" Parting the fuchsia hedge with rough hands, he would repeat some seed wisdom and finish with a verse of, "I'll take you home again, Kathleen." Immersed in an extraordinary natural environment, we move back here, and I'm going to read one of the first poems that I remember writing when we came back to this very, very special landscape, and it's called A Valentine from Megan. This boy and girl work and then walk together through a winter path of birds. Here they talk in the early afternoon as the cardinal to the clear climate of willow. Down to the wet of tidal water, under the common air of the east, within a brief elation of wind, they hear the healing of a child's song. We were lonely and peaceful. We didn't want any sound at all. When a turtle dives from the pond shoulder, they turn for the passage. It's called A Valentine.
This is East End Inc. on WPKN Radio. We're listening to farmer and poet Scott Chaskey reading from his work in April 2020 at a virtual Canio's Cultural Cafe session.
Master Dogon walks in the South Fork. Master Dogon wrote in the 1300s, this is from Master Dogon. To carry yourself forward and experience myriad things is delusion. That myriad things come forth and experience themselves is awakening. So this is Master Dogon walks in the South Fork. The eyes of the fox are shells. Her home is sand, this luminous beach. She is washed by salt water, bleached by sun, wrapped in the calcium ribbon of shellfish. Her body is a skeletal map, a lens, a geographic mark. Did she leave the oaks, descend the dune of marl and scrub, or rise, carried by waves of the sound? Myriad things come forth to make the map of eyes and bone, to mark the art of shell and stone, water, wind. Water, wind, stone, shell, sand. I was asked to speak at a celebration of something, our common home. It's called Laudato Si. It's the encyclical written by the Pope, the present Pope. I probably would not have found this or read this, and so it was fascinating to be asked to speak at this event. And it was held at the Great Hall, it's called in Cooper Union. And I have to say, I've done a lot of thinking, picking these out about the time that we're living in now. And I have to say that it was my turn to go up on stage, and someone pointed out to me, that's Lincoln's podium. So as it turns out, in the Great Hall, an unknown senator from Illinois gave a great speech in 1859 that reportedly was the thing that gave him the boost to the presidency. And when you speak at the Great Hall, you stand at Lincoln's podium. I would like to begin with St. Francis of Assisi's blessing. Blessed be to you, my Lord, through our sister, Mother Earth, who sustains and governs us, and who produces various fruit with colored flowers and herbs. When I speak as a poet, with the words of another Italian, Eugenio Montale, in mind. If I consider poetry as an object, I maintain that it is born of the necessity of adding a vocal sound, speech, to the hammering of the first tribal music. And I know that that music was born of our Mother Earth. Also, when I speak as a farmer, encouraged by the words of the conservationist and writer Aldo Leopold, who wrote, "A thing is right when it tends to support the integrity, the stability, and the beauty of the biota. It is wrong when it tends otherwise." We have lived long enough on this earth to know that distinction. We know it in our bones. The Pope's encyclical acknowledges a kind of knowing or awareness that is not separate from the cycles of nature. And the text of the encyclical, very beautiful in many places, establishes the connection between the destruction of the environment and the plight of the poor. On Care for Our Common Home addresses the potential for an ecological catastrophe under the effective explosion of industrial civilization, and it stresses the urgent need for a radical change in the conduct of humanity. In November, I attended a global CSA, or Community Supported Agriculture Conference, in China. Community farmers and activists from 5 continents and 28 countries were in attendance. And before any critics dismiss such a gathering as the impractical dreaming of the children of the 1960s, which it was, we should remember that 70% of the world's food is grown by small-scale farmers. And given the extraordinary statistic that 1.2 billion people go to bed hungry every night, I'm sure that number has grown at the moment. Despite the fact that we actually produce 2 times the food necessary to feed the present world population, we would be wise to support those who truly care for our common home by careful tillage of the soil, rather than giving our support to a handful of global corporations who are focused on patenting genetic material that has been part of the commons for thousands of years. In the words of the encyclical, we have to realize that a true ecological approach always becomes a social approach. It must integrate questions of justice and debates on the environment so as to hear both the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor. The Pope observes that there is a mystical meaning to be found in a leaf, a mountain trail, and a dewdrop in a poor person's face, and he notes the words of the spiritual writer Ali al-Khawas: "There is a subtle mystery in each of the movements and sounds of this world. The initiate will capture what is being said when the wind blows, the trees sway, water flows, flies buzz, doors creak, birds sing, the sighs of the sick, the groans of the afflicted, or in the sounds of strings or flutes." I was given evidence of the subtle mystery before I left China by a family of farmers who had traveled thousands of miles from their home on the Tibetan plateau. It was their first time, just as it was my first time outside of Beijing. They bowed to me and they called me their main cloud. And they gifted me some flower seeds, cosmos, and also a long white scarf, a symbol of the clouds they bow to daily as they guard the snow-capped mountains and grasslands of the Himalayan plateau, their home. Nothing in this world is indifferent to us, the encyclical says. May we continue to listen to the subtle mysteries in all of the movements and sounds of our natural world, and to have reverence for, and to continue to take care of our common home. One more bit of prose that may seem out of place because it's actually entitled Winter Solstice, but I think there's a message in it that is important to read now for this time that we're going through. Winter Solstice, 2010. Some years ago, at the close of an hour of sitting in Zen meditation, our teacher, Roshi Peter Matheson, reached his hands into his black robe and brought out a small owl he had been trying to revive, held against his body in meditation. The owl had crashed into the glass window of his study. My own thoughts during that hour had wandered far from counting my breath in and out. I was struggling to make sense of the thin veil that separates the living and the dead. In the weeks that followed that Zen sitting, I composed a poem dedicated to my first son, Levin, whose name means bright light or flame. It begins like this. Then the surprise gift of death, the saw-wet's wings and the teacher's hands taken from his black robe, and the white Zendo wood fire cracks, geese crow in the zero air. My back is straight, my wings are wet. I see stone Buddha and the bowl. In the white-walled Zendo, the stark contrast between black and white, living breath and breath extinguished, was beyond metaphor. In that instant, reality was illumined by the lifeless, saw-wet owl in the Roshi's hands, warm and resonant. Over the last few weeks, December 2010, I've been following the path of a star as it rises in the early morning just before 4 a.m. That star is really the planet Venus, which has reached maximum brilliancy this December. Venus is now 25 times brighter than Sirius, normally the brightest star in our firmament. The five points of Venus's pulsing light illuminate the dark sky until the light of the sun invokes an azure blue that surrounds and absorbs our twin planet. Today, on the day we know of as the winter solstice, the sun's light will visit us for approximately 8 hours and 12 minutes. For the first time since 1378, we will experience a total lunar eclipse on a full moon night that coincides with the solstice. To add to the show, the Ursid's meteor shower will be visible in a clear sky because of the eclipse. The Latin word solstice informs us of the moment when the sun appears to stand still. Technically, the event lasts for an instant, though time seems to slow, surrounding the stillness. Solstice is the time of the maximum tilt of Earth's equator relative to the sun. The declination of the sun, when it is furthest from us in the northern hemisphere, occurs at the Tropic of Capricorn. The angle of the tilt of the Earth is measured to be minus 23 degrees, 27 minutes. For us, it is the shortest day, and for those who live in the southern hemisphere, it is the longest. After the still moment of solstice, the sun once again begins an ascent into the northern sky until at the vernal equinox, day equals night. Though we now can name and calculate the movements of celestial bodies, our ancestors would have been more attentive in a familial way. Neolithic humans carved notches in bone to count the moon cycles and the round of the seasons. At Stonehenge, the smooth, flat face of the great Trilithon stone is turned toward the setting midwinter sun, the song of the solstice. At Newgrange in Ireland, a site that is 5,000 years old, for 5 days surrounding the solstice, when the sun appears to stand still, a shaft of sunlight at dawn illumines a passage through massive blocks of stone to light an inner chamber for 17 minutes. The significance of a point in time is incalculable to us, but the builders of those ancient monuments with forethought, imagination, and muscle chose to honor a central celestial mystery. For out of darkness comes light. Out of the unknown, the void, comes rebirth. The Italian poet Quasimodo wrote, "At the center of the world, each man stands alone until pierced by a ray of light, and then suddenly it's dark." The Irish poet William Butler Yeats, inspired by an apocalyptic mood, called up the image of the Christian resurrection with these poetic lines: "The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. Thus, the salvation of man, one of the essential religious doctrines, is intimately linked to a celestial event." As we contemplate the shortest day of the year today, it is good to remember and to repeat that out of darkness comes light. After the still moment that is the solstice, the sun will begin again to climb higher in our northern sky. As I watched for the return of increasing light, I also recall the elusive words of an 8th-century Zen monk who wrote, "In the light, there is darkness, but don't take it as darkness. In the dark, there is light, but don't see it as light." The reality that is at the source and essence of all things, the luminous intelligence that shines forth from the depths of the human heart, is perpetual, and we are reborn each breath by breath. A surprise gift as real and ephemeral as a saw wet's wings held in the teacher's hand.
You've been listening to farmer and poet Scott Chaskey reading his work in celebration of Earth Day at an online session in a series produced by Canio's Cultural Cafe. The event was recorded in April of 2020. Scott Chaskey's book, Seed Time, on the history, husbandry, politics, and promise of seeds, was published in 2014 by Rodale Press. Chaskey's This Common Ground, Seasons on an Organic Farm, was published by Putnam in 2005. Some upcoming free literary events produced by the nonprofit Canio's Cultural Cafe include: on Tuesday, September 1st, novelist Adriana Trajani reads from her work on Canio's Facebook Live. And on Saturday, September 12th at 5:30 p.m., translator Anne Goldstein and author Mary Norris discuss and read from the forthcoming novel by Elena Ferrante, Lying Life of Adults. More events can be found on canios.com. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Catherine Soka and Marianne Calendrill of Canio's Books.